everyone, for being here. It's great to have such a good turnout. I'd first like to introduce Mahmoud Abu Rasool from CJP at OSU.
Of my country. I have been harassed at checkpoints and in airports. I have lived under military curfew. I know what it's like to be told that I can't go to school because a soldier who doesn't speak my language or respect my flag says that I can't. You may think that it's irrelevant now because I'm in America. You may think I live freely and sleep well at night. But I ask you, how can I be free, live freely in another man's country? Yes, my eyes may shut as I am laying at night to rest, but my heart hasn't slept in years. How can my heart sleep when my identity is questioned every day? People deny I am Palestinian. They say, how can you be Palestinian when there is no Palestine? They say it's a place that used to be, but no longer is. Some deny it ever was. To many others, Palestine is a word used by politicians as a bargaining tool, a symbol, or a reference. To me, Palestine is, Palestine was, and Palestine always will be. I am Palestinian by inheritance. My father is Palestinian, and his father was Palestinian as his father and his father. An old lady once said, there is no such thing as Palestinians. She was mistaken. For I am Palestinian, by inheritance. I am Palestinian by birth, by blood, by culture, by faith, by religion. We are all Palestinians. We convene here today to prove to others that there are Palestinians, there is a Palestine, and there always will be a Palestine. As long as there are Palestinians, there will always be a Palestine. So we must always be Palestinians. We must continue to prove to the world that we exist, that we care, that we will survive. Every time we hold a conference, every speech we give, every letter we write, every phone call we make proves to more and more people that we are all Palestinians. Home is where the heart is, and my heart is in Palestine. On behalf of the Committee for Justice in Palestine at The Ohio State University, I thank you for your support. Thank you for your dedication, and thank you for your Palestine. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming, and I hope this experience will be as educational as possible. As a word of advice, say Palestine every chance you get. Write it everywhere. Breathe it, feel it, and live it. So wear your keffiyehs, raise your flags, and prove you are Palestinian. Thank you again for coming. Be free, be safe, be free, and be Palestine.
Have a few announcements here. Please, everybody, just turn off your cell phones. We need more volunteers, so if anybody is willing to volunteer, please register here on the registration desk with Sean. Tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, general body meeting is going to be held in the West Ballroom. Any school or organization that would like to give a report back with their progresses are welcome. Please, for individual registrations, please come tomorrow. It's going to start at 8 in the morning. And tomorrow there's going to be a football game, as you all know. So for traffic and parking problems, please get here as early as you can. A last announcement, there's going to be an international night in downtown. So if you're interested, you're willing to go, please get one of these cards from the registrations list. Thanks.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Mary Kate Schott. I represent Sustain DC. I've been organizing with the Palestine Solidarity Movement for this conference. And on behalf of the PSM, I'd like to first thank the Committee for Justice in Palestine for doing such a wonderful job organizing all the logistics, the space, and setting up everything. Thank you all very, very much. And thank you all for coming and representing Palestine and showing your solidarity with the Palestinian people and coming to hear our wonderful panelists. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture Towards a Global Intifada, Building Palestinian Solidarity with Other Liberation Struggles. Ashanti Alston, Fatima Ayoub, Vernon Bellacourt, and Nora Arakat will all give us their perspectives and some of their wisdom on the movement. First, Ashanti Alston. Ashanti Alston is a former member of the Black Panther Party and a former prisoner of war. He is presently a member of Estación Libre, People of Color Zapatista Support Group, a board member of the Institute for Anarchist Studies and the Northeast U.S. Partner for Critical Resistance.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank you for inviting me here. You can hear me, right? Okay. It is really an honor to be here. This is the first time that I have been asked to speak, you know, in support of Palestinian struggle, a struggle that's been very dear to me for many, many years. My history is out of the Black Panther Party, and we always was an organization that supported the liberation of Palestine. We wasn't borderline on that issue. We felt that Palestinians needed total liberation. There wasn't no need for any compromise on anything. It was a people who had suffered terrible suffering, that there was no need to find some kind of middle solution for any president to intervene or anything. The Palestinian people can decide what they want. Mm-hmm. And I think all through these years, they have been just, fair, humane about their solutions. Some of the little circus that we've seen outside today, you know, is very funny to me, because these people out here who are saying that this conference supports terrorism, I mean, come on. You know, I mean, what they do to the Palestinian people every day you turn on that news, and you know that's only a fraction of what's really going on there, you know. I feel it every time I watch that news. What makes it more personal for me is that, you know, I happen to know many Palestinians, and some I'm very close to. So I wanted to just start off by just reading a letter. I had asked the Hamad sisters in New York, who are all Palestinians, and one of them we might know from Def Jam Poetry, the thing on Broadway. She was in there. That was Suhair. But I asked them to give me something. What do you want me to tell the folks here? So Suzanne had sent me an email and expressed some things, so I just wanted to read that, because I think it's real important that we hear the voice of Palestine. We hear the voice of people who suffer, even if they've been in this country most of their lives. Palestine is in their heart. So this is Suzanne Hamad. And she says, basically, the message I want to send to Palestinians in Ohio and America at large is that we need to organize to resist what is going on right now. I want people to remember that it is and has only been our ability to resist that has allowed us to sustain ourselves as a community, to survive the daily dose of genocide, to inspire millions of people worldwide to not only stand up for Palestine, but to stand up against oppression in all forms. As Palestine continues to be attacked, we must continue to organize and resist. We cannot be afraid. We must let people know what's going on and show them that we are against it. We must publicize the building of Israel's apartheid wall in order to confront the powers that be behind it. We must show not only the basic humanity of our people, but our incredible dignity in the face of all odds. We must remember that we are fighting for a just cause. We know that many Palestinians have been deported since 9/11. Many of us are in jail right now with no rights. Still more of us have had certain government agencies visit our homes, our workplace. Are we all to deal with this racism, this oppression alone as individuals? Is each and every individual facing this right now trying to just get by? Or are we going to come together and face this as a community? What odds do we have in defeating our oppressors as one person? What are our odds if we work together as one? We need to understand that we are not alone. And by we, I do not just mean Palestinians. All people have their own narratives, the collective experience of Palestinian oppression is not exactly the same as that of black people in South Africa or various indigenous communities in Africa and Latin America, but we do have a lot in common. Are we communicating with these communities in the world who are resisting? Are we watching and learning from them too? Are we coming together, respecting one another's rich culture and history of resistance? Are we recognizing our shared experience against a common enemy and building on that? Who are the communities right here in America who have been fighting against oppression and racism? Solidarity is key. We see people fight every day in Palestine, but the truth is that unless we continue to build international solidarity for our cause, nothing will change. The world of resistors need to unite. Remember that if you are a woman or a person of color and you can vote today, that is because women and African Americans organized for that and won. If you have had access to any non-European courses in college, whether it be Black and Puerto Rican studies at CUNY or Middle East studies or the study of conquered peoples, know that we have that today because people pulled together to fight for these things and they won. That's Suzanne. And I wanted to read that because Suzanne is a young Palestinian woman. And, like, I've watched Suzanne grow. For me, you know, it's like they have the government, this government, the Zionists and others have used the Palestinian struggle to, like, paint a picture of some horrible people, you know, people who are terrorists, barbarians, monsters. But it's the same picture that they painted of indigenous people's struggles here and our leaders, people of African descent, Latinos, same thing. When people fight back, they paint you as monsters. They paint you as terrorists. But we always got to be very mindful of who's calling who these names. What I think is very important about the Palestinian struggle is that it came at a time, or at least when it got international recognition, it was because they found ways of letting the world know what was going on. They were a struggle that was silenced by world media, but found a way to cry out that their voice would be heard all over the galaxy. And whether it took a hijacking, whether it took holding so-called hostages somewhere, they did what they had to do. But even when we saw the pictures of the hijacking or the hostages, so-called, because I don't really believe anybody is innocent, right? It's that there was always struggles on the ground in Palestine to rebuild community, to draw from the strength of their cultures and their belief, to rebuild themselves at the same time that others, revolutionaries, guerrillas, and all their leading spokespeople were fighting for that cause and advancing that cause. That's a very tough struggle. And I understand it so well because it's the same thing that we went through as Panthers, the same thing. Our voice was out there, but a lot of times it seemed like no one heard it. No one heard it, but those others who were suffering the same thing as us. I think what's very important is that, and I think we haven't had it since the 60s, is that we need to begin to bring these struggles back together again. We need to really hear ourselves. And I think that the Palestinian struggle gave us that example, because no struggle inspired us like that struggle, and like the Vietnamese struggle. So one of the things a lot of people don't know about the Black Panther Party is that there was certain members of the Black Panther Party who went to Palestine, who were trained by Palestinian guerrillas, who came back to the United States to fight, you know, and didn't ask anything from us. It was just the fact that they know that we wanted to learn and that we were fighting in the belly of the beast. And we are always indebted to them for that. You know, because here in this country, we also are under no illusions that this government, these politicians, these corporations will overnight have some kind of miraculous morality change and become some good people. All right? The things that we've seen outside today always tells me that we're going to fight, you know, and it's going to be some tough fighting and some people going to get hurt. And it's not what you want, but we don't set them terms up. If there's justice, amongst those who oppress us, then they should step down. If they don't want no bloodshed, they don't want no suffering, step down. Let people create new lives. That's all you got to do. If you're not going to do that, then you create a situation where there's going to be some very tough struggles. Malcolm said, and I'm going to be very brief, Malcolm said there'll be terrorism that will terrify you. And he said that knowing that it wasn't because the oppressed wanted that. It was because of the intransigence of our oppressors that they would not stop now, that you put people in a position to fight by any means necessary. And the only thing I think we have to do is that when we're in that situation, we just got to find all kind of ways to hold on to our humanity while we're fighting with all that we got. I think that what's before us today is finding ways to reunite again, to network again, to be able to bring our struggles and our strengths together in this country so that we can be able to help everybody around the world, because we are in the belly of the beast. We are. And if we can defeat this one here, Israel, the state, has no way to defend itself anymore. And I think that's what's real important. We need to fight here. That is the best way we can help anybody anywhere in the world. Let's get to this one right here. So that's all I want to say with that. And I really encourage people, no matter how tough this struggle is, no matter how tough it's for us as individuals, to cross that line, because it's a fearful line, but it's a line that we know we got to cross a lot of time to be able to make advances, to unite with people, and to confront our enemies. We need to begin to do that, because the more we use our privilege not to cross that line, the suffering around the world and right here within our own country continues. The only way we can stop this monster is to step in this face.
Mr. Bellacourt has been part of many of the most historic battles in the current liberation of the American Indians, including the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969, the Trail of Broken Treaties, and the subsequent occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1971, and the Wounded Knee Standoff in 1973 as well. He is a special representative of the International Indian Treaty Council and helped organize the first treaty conference in 1974 and organized the historic demonstrations at the 1992 Redskin Super Bowl.
It's kind of hard to say that word, isn't
it? Yeah. Without further ado, Mr. Bellacourt.
Thank you. I did all of that. I thought we did all of that. Buju Nishnabe. Ani Niji, Indinwe Mugani Dug, Wabananini Indijnakaz, Ajijo Kindo Dame, Gawa Babi, Kanika, Ganishinabe, and Dana Kiwad. What I essentially said was greetings, dear people, and a very warm welcome. Wabananini Indijnakaz means that my real name is Man of Dawn. I'm a member of the Crane clan, Crane family, Anishinaabe people, commonly called the Chippewa. And I come from a place in northern Minnesota that we call Gawa Babi Ganikog, Anishinaabe, and Dana Kiwad, which is the white earth Ojibwe community, a place where the Ojibwe or Chippewa people live. So I greet you very warmly in that way. Somebody said, why do they call it White Earth? Because it's mostly occupied by white Americans. So we know something of occupation. Several days ago, I received an overnight communique from a very dear friend who is also a member of the board of directors of the National Coalition on Racism in Sports and Media, of which, along with Charlene Teeters, who is featured in the award-winning video, In Whose Honor, about racist imagery in American popular culture. Of course, when we speak about American popular culture, we still haven't quite figured out what that is. One of our elders one time said to the question, Well, isn't it McDonald's wrappers and Pampers? Is that American popular culture? So that's another whole issue that could be discussed for several hours before we would even get to understanding anything about it. I was interested in my brother here talking about what we characterize as the rhetoric of genocide. It used to be fighting Indians. You know, we were Indians, not even indigenous people, but Indians. And, of course, if you were to look at Random House Dictionary, you would have some other words that are part of the American rhetoric of genocide. You will find words like, and I hate to use these words, but for this purpose, I'm going to use them. You'll find words like kike, wop, honky, spick, chink, patties, niggers, and redskins. And that is the rhetoric of genocide in America. You have to demean and degrade and dehumanize a people as part of the process of ethnocide and genocide. It used to be fighting evil communists, and now it's terrorist. Anyone that disagrees with the occupiers, in this case the United States and the State of Israel, are dismissed as being terrorists. You can kill terrorists, you can't kill human beings. At least get away with it for a long period of time. Case in point, in 1999, ex-President William Clinton was speaking in Guatemala City, and he said something like this: "The United States was wrong to have supported Guatemalan security forces in their brutal counterinsurgency campaigns that claimed the lives of thousands of innocent victims, citizens, people. Let me make it clear that support for these kinds of security forces that engaged in widespread repression of the kind outlined in the historic Clarification Commission report is wrong, and America should not do it again." Well, obviously, the current leadership in Washington did not hear that message. My friends, more than 150,000 Mayan Indian people, indigenous people, have been brutally murdered, raped, burnt, buried alive by Guatemalan security forces, armed and trained and supported by the United States government. Those deaths intensified tenfold under the presidency, and before that, head of the CIA, George Bush Sr. In about 1980, 82, and 83, our movement, the American Indian Movement, was engaged in an effort to disengage the indigenous peoples of Nicaragua, who were being manipulated out of Honduras by the Central Intelligence Agency in order to overthrow the Sandinista Revolution. During that time, one of the young men in the foreign ministry of the Sandinista government took us to a large auditorium. And as we walked in, we seen tons and tons of military hardware, particularly AK-47s and other weapons. And what they told us was that the fact is just before that, Ariel Sharon visited Guatemala and El Salvador. And the weapons that they had taken off of the CIA Contra operating out of Honduras against the people of Nicaragua were transported by Israel to Central America by Ariel Sharon and others of the Israeli government. And these weapons were traced to the massacre of Sabra and Shatila, where Ronald Reagan bragged about dropping shells the size of Volkswagens on those communities in support of the State of Israel. And so we have a real interest in standing in resolute solidarity with the Palestinian people, with the people of Afghanistan, and others who are struggling against U.S. domination in that part of the world. I would urge you to go to the website of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission. It's both in English and Spanish. And take a look at the historical Clarification Commission report. And you will find the kind of barbarity that was taking place against the indigenous people in particular, but all Guatemalan people, people who wanted democracy, true freedom. And you will see the direct connection in that the death squad government and their military bragged that the Uzi submachine gun was the weapon of choice, where they literally massacred the people of 400 and some villages under the George Bush administration. So when we talk about terrorism, who is going to hold George Bush Sr. and other governments of the United States who since 1954, when the CIA overthrew the democratic elected government of Jacobo Arbenz, who is going to hold these people responsible for the kind of crimes that were perpetrated against the people of Guatemala? 100,000+ in El Salvador. 60,000-70,000 Nicaraguans lost their lives at the hands of the United States government with the support of the racist apartheid regime in South Africa and the Israeli government. And we can understand when we look back at our history, since the coming of the colonial pirate Christopher Columbus, hundreds of millions of indigenous people in South America have been wiped from the face of this earth. In what is called the United States alone, 16 million of us have been destroyed by the illegal settlers who came here from all over the world. I maybe mentioned earlier that I had a telephone conversation with a very good friend who's on the board of directors of one of our organizations. He works with the American Jewish Congress. And he said that his concerns were that anti-Semitism is creeping into the student solidarity movements for Palestine. And I said to this man, I said, I thought that Arabs were Semitic also. So I'd like to know the difference of what you're talking about. I do know that these settlers who are coming from all over Europe, similar to what happened to us, are occupying every day, bulldozing the homes, killing Palestinian people. Somebody said 4.5 million. I didn't realize it was that high of refugees that have been driven from their homes. And now they don't want them to come back. And we have people in this country. I'll start with a few names that come to mind. Wolfowitz, Dershowitz, Pearl, Ladine, McGavney, William Sapphire. We're putting them on notice that we have 1,000 more times, more reasons, that if they continue to support the illegal occupation of Palestine, the bulldozing of Palestinian homes, schools, hospitals, that we have every right, once we find out where they live, we will notify them to get out of our homes. You know, somebody said, if you Indians don't like it, why don't you come go back where you came from? You know, we tell them, well, let us know where you live. We'll put up our wigwam and teepee in your backyard because that's where we came from. So we would like to put them on notice that we expect that within a reasonable period of time, the Piscataways of Virginia and Washington, D.C., remnants of those nations, may want to come back and reclaim their homes, ask them to expel them from their homes. And if they don't like it, we might even have to bulldoze a few of them. You know, they got to be held to the same standard. They got to be held to the same standard. And when we see CIA, assassination teams, operating against the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, these are hired guns, killers. And then they lie to us. I picked up a newspaper yesterday where this young Jessica Lynch continues to protest that she wasn't raped. But they're telling you, you got to say you're raped whether you like it or not. They continue to lie to us. They talk about the Arab states should now adopt democracy. Following Florida and the elections a couple years ago, maybe America has to adopt some democracy right here. Who are they to impose their form of democracy against what they consider democracy, against other peoples of the world? And it is that kind of arrogance, supporting the assassination. What's the United States? What's their legal right to be in Iraq? The Pope said it's a sin. The Dixie Chick said it was wrong. They must be wrong. I didn't say that. What's his name? Bowling for Columbine said that. I really like that guy. I'd like to meet him someday. One of the few Americans that makes sense. It's true. Assassinating the sons of Saddam Hussein. Murdering their family with high-tech weapons and missiles. Murdering families in Palestine the same way. Doesn't George Bush know that if you put out that kind of standard, that you have to submit to the same standard? Wouldn't it be outrageous if his family was all of a sudden targeted? It would be terrible. But how can they continue to perpetuate that kind of violence without them having to submit to the same standard? Now, for the purpose of time, there are many other things I would like to say. Maybe tomorrow I'll have an opportunity. But I'm telling you this, my friends. The crimes committed against the indigenous Mapuche people in Chile, the indigenous people in Guatemala, is in fact a crime against humanity. And we know who the war criminals are. We know who the war criminals are. And following that stealing of the election in Miami, Americans who claim to love democracy and the U.S. Constitution should be outraged. We should have been marching on Washington by the millions to bring this government down by whatever means necessary. But Americans just roll back and lay back and take it. And I don't believe we should even wait for the next election, because if they can steal elections in Chile, they can steal elections in the United States. After all, they control all the computers. We shouldn't wait. We should build a massive movement to call for an impeachment and to get those thugs out of the White House and out of the Capitol. And the John Kerrys and the Liebermans, a guy from Missouri, what's his name? I can't think of it. Hey, every one of those that supported that resolution giving Bush the authority to do what he's doing against people of Iraq, we should not consider voting for any of them. We should vote for the people that were opposed to it and have been consistently opposed to it, like Kucinich and others. You know, Sharpton's looking better to me all the time. But we should put those others on notice that they've given up their right to be president of the United States by supporting Bush. And also, when it comes to the Senate and congressional races, we should start seriously looking at viable third-party candidates. I say viable. We don't want to throw our votes away on a party that ain't going to make it anyhow. But at the same time, we've got to get those thugs out of the White House. They're war criminals. They should be held accountable. We should call for a people's tribunal. And when found guilty, we should be committed enough to carry out the sentence. Me Gwich, thank you very much. Final comment that I thought is important. You know, I talked to my good friend from the American Jewish Congress, and I said, you know, Ken, I'm gonna try to be more tolerant in my comments and recognize that there's Jewish people throughout the world, including in occupied Palestine, who are against what the government of Israel is doing. And we should not categorize all of them in the same way. But I mentioned down there, when I got out of the car, I couldn't believe it. Here was an Indian brother speaking in his language. And those Zionist thugs were out there trying to shout him down. At the same time, they say they believe in freedom of speech. Isn't that outrageous? When I seen him in our country trying to shout down an Indian man making some comments, that's why I charged when I got out of the car. And some time ago, I met Chairman Arafat. And I know there's just a lot of differences even among the Arab community about whether Chairman Arafat is a good leader or not. I met him in Benghazi some time ago. My companion in struggle, some call him a wife, met Chairman Arafat in Benghazi, and I didn't know what to say. I felt really good having a chance to meet this man on the front line of the struggle, along with Palestinian young people. I said, I'm looking back at my history, and I said, you know, Mr. Chairman, we are the Palestinians, and the Palestinians are we. So I just wanted to share that with you. It was a very good meeting. Thank you. Be good.
Fatima Ayu. Fatima is an MA student at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C., and holds a BA in International Politics from George Mason University in Virginia. She has been actively engaged in human rights work for Palestine, Afghanistan, and Iraq for the past 3 years. Fatima also was an organizing member for the PSM and a spokesperson. We thank her very much for the PSM and organizing this conference. Fatima is currently active with... Sorry, go ahead, Fatima.
Okay. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you all. Welcome to the third annual conference of the Palestine Solidarity Movement. I would like to start off by saying that I in no way have the experience and the wisdom of our esteemed panelists here, that I consider it a very great honor to be sitting on the same panel with them. And I don't hope so much to impart any great words of wisdom to you, but I do hope that in some sense I can leave you with my reflections on what it means for us as activists to be engaged in global struggles. My family is originally from Afghanistan. My parents were refugees from the Soviet invasion in 1979. And my first role model was my late grandfather, who passed away 3 years ago. During the Soviet invasion, he was made a prisoner as he was a minister in the cabinet. And after a year and a half of being in prison, my grandfather would never concede to the demands of the Soviets, who beat and tortured him. And after a year and a half, managed to smuggle his way out of prison. And his message to me was always that we as humans must always stand by one another in our struggles to achieve equality and to achieve freedom. And as I was growing up, it was my grandfather's habit to make me memorize poetry. And Afghanistan, like in Arab culture, has a very strong tradition of passing poetry down from generation to generation, and this is how we retain one aspect of the culture. And I'm going to recite the poem for you in Farsi and then provide a very inadequate translation. But the poem says, Bani Adam azoy yak digarand, ke dar afarinish siyak jawharand, che uzwe badard awarad ruzgar, digar uzwahara namanad qarar. And in translation, this poem says that the tribe of humanity is like one human body. And if any one single limb is in pain, then let no part of the body lie at rest. When we look throughout the world, we can see countless examples of the atrocities that face humanity day to day, year by year, decade to decade, century to century. And it continues. And so do we, for that matter. We push forward with our activism. We push forward for the preservation of Palestinian life, dignity, freedom. We can see that thousands of activists across this country have launched boycotts and divestment campaigns to highlight our ethical responsibility to those humans in the world who suffer. In launching divestment campaigns, we point the first finger of ethical responsibility towards ourselves. And we acknowledge that in 1948, the plight of the Palestinian people began, but that every single day moving forward, that we will try and help stop it here and now on our campuses and in our communities. The brutalization of Palestine by the Israeli occupation plays out against an ongoing theater of horror throughout the world. And I don't feel like, you know, listing them down for all of you. We're all aware of what is going on in Palestine on a daily basis, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Kashmir, in Chechnya, in South America, in Mexico, on our own soil in the United States. It's very clear that day by day, the condition of humanity is getting worse. It's far beyond the standards of human decency to have situations whereby half of the population of sub-Saharan Africa is to be diagnosed with AIDS by 2020. This is beyond human decency. It's beyond the human imagination that we know that this is happening in the world and that there's very little that we try to do to stop it. And I want to say that we, as a divestment movement, what we are highlighting is our ethical choices and responsibilities. And clearly, we've made a commitment as individuals to reconsider the ramifications of our financial decisions and to press our communities and academic institutions to do likewise. And as an activist movement, this is our ultimate goal, to establish the freedom of the Palestinian people that they so badly deserve. And I would ask us to look even more deeply at what being an activist entails. When we stand up and we argue for social justice, whether we are Afghan or whether we are Palestinian, whether we are Iraqi, whether we are a Native American, whether we are Black Americans, when we stand up and we advocate for freedom and social justice, I say that we need to broaden the scope of our understanding beyond just saying that we can identify with your state of being oppressed and that we can identify with the struggles that you've had over the past decades and centuries in many cases. But I want to point out that what brings us together as activists is the fact that at the end of the day, more than anything else, before we are Palestinian, before we are Afghan, before we are any race, any religion, any ethnicity, any creed, any ideology, we are first and foremost human. And that our place in this world depends solely on our mutual respect and our ability to establish the dignity that every human being on this earth deserves. If we are going to fight for the solidarity and the liberation of these struggles, we have to comprehend that your struggle is my struggle because you are human. I am human, and in that sense, I can comprehend your suffering as you can comprehend mine. And if we can understand this, and if we can truly get our minds around this, then the possibilities of our activism are endless, because the nature of human suffering, as I can see it, it doesn't have measure, but we can relate to it. We are all of one human body. Our pain is one pain. And to speak from my own personal experience of what experience I've had, that as a Muslim, when I'm engaged in the work for Palestine, for example, we can see very often that Muslims will be engaged in work for Palestinian freedom, but at the same time, they won't be able to identify with the human rights struggles of other people around the world. And oftentimes because, and I see this as dire short-sightedness on the part of Muslims, oftentimes is that they cannot identify with someone else if they are not Muslim. They cannot identify with the struggle for human rights simply because the other person is not Muslim. I believe this is wrong. If you are an activist for good and for right, then wherever you see wrong and oppression, you stand firm against it, regardless of what that other person's identity is. You see them as a human. You know that they deserve what you deserve. And I'm by no means suggesting that any one person's religion or ethnicity should try and be put aside in, you know, this collective idea of you know, one humanity. Rather, I think that, you know, our religion and our identity, our cultures, are a richness to the collective human experience. But at the baseline, when we are fighting for an essential human right, we need to understand that I am as human as you are, wherever you are in the world, whoever you are in the world. And I think that if we can truly understand this, this is what will solidify us as a movement for social justice. And then when we come together with our hearts, our minds, and our voices to say Free Palestine, we can say it convincingly, and we know that we are standing with all of humanity when we say it. Thank you.
And our final panelist, Nora Arakat. Nora is a Palestinian American student activist and a second year law school student at UC Berkeley. She studied and lived in Israel, the occupied Palestinian territories, where she co-led American delegations throughout the region as a global exchange Middle East program coordinator. And she also spent time studying Hebrew at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Nora collected oral history from Palestinian civilians during the beginning of the most recent Palestinian uprisings that began in the late September of 2000. She later used the material to write and direct a revolving monologue entitled Pulse of the Intifada. After being selected as the Elfan 2003 Theater Initiative, the play has been performed in Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, San Francisco, and Berkeley. In the summer of 2002, she volunteered at Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. She spent more than 10 weeks living in Haifa and working at Shafar Abdullah, Legal Center for Arab Minority Civil Rights in Israel. During her stay, she helped file petitions within the Israeli Supreme Court challenging Israel's institutionalized discrimination against Palestinian Israelis and regards to their education, social benefits, political participation, and basic human rights. Nora is now working on her second radio documentary exploring the contradiction of a Jewish and a democratic state based on the material she collected while in Israel.
Thank you. I'm incredibly, incredibly honored to be in the presence of you all, and especially in the presence of these panelists, and to be on the same panel. And I think before I start, I just want to, this is the first annual Edward Said Memorial. And I really do just want to pay tribute to his life and to his contribution to all of us and to all of our struggles. So, I don't know how many of you actually saw an email from his daughter Nejla that was circulated, but his final words were fight and fight hard for Palestine. Even in his last breaths, he was fighting for Palestine. And so that's, I mean, I just want to invoke his spirit here with us today. My goal for all of you now, because I know you're all hardcore, is to convince you beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm going to use my legal jingo, beyond a reasonable doubt that we have to wage a divestment campaign. If you're not already convinced, I'm not going to let you leave before you say, we have no other choice, we must divest, we must. And so I'm going to do that in two ways. The first way is, I want to show how Israel is an apartheid regime, not just of its occupation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but in its structure as a state within the Green Line, within the 1948 borders of what we know as Israel proper, making it exactly the same as South Africa was in its entirety. The second way, if that doesn't work, is to continue by exploring other options that we have in order to remedy human rights violations against the Palestinian population, against their right to self-determination, whether it be in the International Criminal Court, whether it be in the Israeli Supreme Court, or whether it be in international courts through universal jurisdiction. Bottom line is that it's not our fault we're waging a divestment campaign. Israel and the U.S. have given us no other choice. So, let me begin. Item number one. The first thing that when we talk about Palestine in the United States, immediately what comes to mind is the struggle in the occupied territories. It's a struggle in the West Bank and Gaza. It's about a military occupation. It's carnage. It's violence. And because of that, it obscures the reality that Israel in its entirety is an apartheid regime. When it was created in 1948, Israel's creation, resulted in the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians, the destruction of 530 villages, a refugee population today that I think is more than 4.5 million. I've read numbers of 5.5 million, 59 refugee camps throughout the Arab world. Now, not the entire Palestinian indigenous population left their homeland. Approximately 100,000 Palestinians remained. And those Palestinians immediately obtained Israeli citizenship upon the creation of Israel, and today constitute 20% of the Israeli population. They are the Palestinian Israelis, or what Israel likes to call the Arab Israelis to negate their national identity. Now, upon the creation of Israel, in their Declaration of Independence, notice the quotes, Declaration of Independence, or occupation, or colonization, in any case, in their declaration, they commit themselves to two principles. The first is the ingathering of the exiles, meaning Jewish exiles only, and the second is a commitment to equality of all of its citizens. I don't think that you can have both a democratic state and a Jewish state. It's a contradiction. And when faced with the challenge, of reconciling this contradiction, Israel consistently and unabashedly sacrifices its democratic commitment to maintain its Jewish character. Now, Justice Shamgar, who is one of the first Supreme Court justices on the Israeli Supreme Court, has said, Israel's Jewishness doesn't mean it can't be democratic. Israel is as Jewish as France is French. Okay, with one glaring difference. In France, citizenship is based on territory, or jus soli. In Israel, citizenship is based on blood, jus sanguinis. Noam Chomsky has said, the Zionist dream is to construct a state which is as Jewish as England is English and France is French. At the same time, the state is to be a democracy on the Western model. Evidently, these goals are incompatible. Citizens of France are French, but citizens of the Jewish state may be non-Jews, either by ethnic or religious origin, or simply by choice. To the extent that Israel is a Jewish state, it cannot be a democratic state. And that they have proved over and over again since its inception. Again, and they do it, and I'm going to demonstrate it, through the relationship with their Palestinian-Israeli minority. Beginning in 1948, upon its establishment, Israel declared that its Palestinian minority within Israel is an enemy of the state. They declared that they were a fifth column within the state. And they didn't do it by standing up and saying, you are the enemy. They did it by imposing military rule upon its own citizens. That military rule didn't end until 1966. And it was no coincidence that that was 1 year before the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, when then they thought it would be dangerous to occupy to oppress the Palestinians both within our borders and in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They continued to tell their Palestinian-Israeli minority that you are enemies of the state by adopting the emergency regulations. Emergency regulations, folks, were first enacted by the British under their mandate in 1945. It was a colonial mechanism used to quell indigenous uprisings, used to quell any movement for self-determination. When Israel was established, they adopted it. Do you think they got rid of it? Unfortunately, no. Those emergency regulations are alive and strong. And this year, when I worked at Adala, a legal center this summer, that filed petitions in the Israeli Supreme Court for Palestinian minority rights. When we filed this case to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, they responded in their concluding observations that Israel continues to be in violation of Article 4, which prohibits any kind of emergency regulation. And they said that whatever derogation may exist, it may only be specified, quote, to the extent strictly required by the exigencies of the situation. Excuse the mispronunciation. Other examples include hate speech within the state. It's not just among the populations and this thing between people, oh, I hate the Arabs, that goes on among Jewish Israeli citizens. It's sanctioned by the leaders, by government officials in the Knesset. In fact, in a March 2002 survey conducted by Tel Aviv University of 1,264 Jewish Israeli citizens, 31% said they support transfer of the Palestinian Israeli populations from within their border. 60% said that they should at least be encouraged to leave. 61% said that the minority poses a threat to Israeli security. This is 2002. Imagine if any other nation said that about their minority population. And that hatred and that state-sanctioned discrimination expressed itself most violently in October of 2000 when Palestinian-Israeli citizens were protesting the indiscriminate aggression and excessive force used by the Israeli forces in the occupied territories. And 13 Palestinian Israelis were shot down on October 1st, 2nd, and 3rd under the discretion of Ehud Barak, then Prime Minister, who said, "You end it by any means necessary." Even his own citizens. The citizens which his Declaration of Independence said will be provided equality. And that's why I decided to go to Adala this summer. Because as dire attention as is needed to be focused on the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, it would be short-sighted of us not to call Israel out for its all-out apartheid regime. And so to demonstrate what this looks like, I just want to tell you about three cases that we worked on this summer. And that involves the democratic threat or the existential threat that Israel thinks it faces, the security threat, and the institutionalized racism. In April 1967, Israel created the Demography Council, which was a think tank. And the think tank was dedicated and funded in order to find ways to increase the Jewish-Israeli population and to decrease the Palestinian-Israeli population. But then in 1967, they were much more vulgar about it. They literally said, they literally tried to give disincentives to Palestinians to procreate more and more incentives to Jewish Israelis to produce more children. They put a moratorium on this council in 1998, and after 5 years of inactivity, they activated again this year. And the state funds it. But this time, they've become a lot more civil. Now they don't give any disincentives to the Palestinian Israelis. They just give incentives to the Jewish Israelis, telling them, well, if you have more babies, you'll get more benefits. We might give you a bigger house. You might get more loans for your children to go to school. Right, benign. But it becomes nothing short of a sterilization project. as other examples will show. And in fact, when Shoshana Arbeli Al-Muslino, the former Israeli health minister and member of the Demography Council, was put to task about this discrimination, she responded, "Why did we establish a state if in the end it will be democratic but not Jewish? What do they want? That I should encourage Arabs to have more children? To have 15 instead of 10? The Jewish people must survive and do everything it can to ensure that it does." Notice the mention of the snippets of racism. That Palestinians are just breathing out of control anyway. They don't need incentives. They're having 10. What, we're going to encourage them to have 15? I'm a part of a family of 4, by the way. Okay. We dropped the case against the state of Israel primarily because we thought we would lose. Primarily, we didn't want to set a legal precedent in Israel because the political situation is so shaky right now. But a case that we haven't dropped was one that challenged the ban on family unification in Israel. This summer, the state of Israel put a ban on citizenship, eligibility, residency for any Palestinian from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So if a Palestinian Israeli living in Haifa, which is 30 minutes away from Jenin on the northwesternmost point of the West Bank, met each other, which is very, very common, it's only 30 minutes away, and they got married, they can't live in Israel because the Palestinian from Jenin is denied access to naturalization. Blanket collective punishment. As if today we told Chicano Americans on the border of Mexico and the US, you can't marry a Mexican because we're not going to give them citizenship. They're a security threat. And what was Israel's rationalization for this security threat? That 6 supposed suicide bombings were enacted or helped, facilitated by Palestinian Israelis who had a parent from the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. Because of 6 alleged security threats, thousands of families will be affected, and hundreds of thousands of individuals will be affected. One such example was Mrs. Tbila and her husband. Her husband is from Nablus. They have 2 daughters. He went through the naturalization process. Israel has a 4-year naturalization process whereby you get residency and are checked, are updated every 6 months, kind of like the U.S. before you get a green card. But that's what they ended. Anyways, so her husband was supposed to get his citizenship next year. Because of this ban that can be enacted retroactively to all applications before May 12th of 2002, imagine, of 2002, people will be stripped of their citizenship and families will be split apart. And she says, "Since the cabinet's decision, we live in constant fear of what lies ahead for us. This fear is even stronger with the new law. Being a young couple and parents of a young girl and a 4-month-old baby, not knowing the most basic thing for every family, could we continue living together as a family, makes our lives bitter. After the cabinet's decision, although we desperately wanted to have another child, we had a difficult time deciding whether to bring another child to this world because of the worry of what destiny lies ahead for our family in this cruel reality that we live in." The ICCPR responded that this was a violation of Articles 17, 23, and 26 of their covenant. The Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination in its 63rd session said that this was a violation of their own covenant. But what is the legal remedy? The Israeli Supreme Court is not an option. They're too biased. They're an impartial party. It's like having a military court and a general is going to figure out whether or not one of his soldiers actually committed a massacre. It's a convolution and a conflict of interests. So what are our other options? There's the International Criminal Court, which was a breakthrough. The Rome Statute was signed on July 8th, 2002. This set a precedent for the rest of the world that no longer will we tolerate any type of war crimes or crimes against humanity. We won't tolerate another Milosevic, another Pinochet, or another Hitler. Now, Israel voted negative against the International Criminal Court. Their reasoning? Israel said that because of Article 8, Paragraph 2B, Subsection 8, which considers transferring of a civilian population into occupied territories as one of the most heinous and egregious war crimes, that Israel can't sign the covenant. Because this is obviously not about human rights. This is about the UN and the international community wanting to attack Israel again. Despite the fact that Article 8 is based on Article 49 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949. It isn't about attacking Israel. It's about fundamental human rights and a fundamental notion of what war crimes are. In fact, Article 49 of the Geneva Convention and that Fourth Geneva Convention itself was written in response to what happened to the Jewish European population during the Nazi regime. Shame on Israel for not ratifying the ICC. And the reason that it didn't ratify it, and the real reason that it didn't ratify it, is because how could it not continue its colonial settler project embodied in settlements in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, where today 59% of the West Bank is dedicated to 367,000 settlers, while 2 million Palestinians live on the rest of the land. And in the Gaza Strip, 7,000 Jewish Israelis live in the Gaza Strip on 20% of the land, where 1.1 million Palestinians in Gaza live on the rest of the land. That is what Israel was afraid of. So what about other legal remedies? There's universal jurisdiction. Why don't we take Israel to court like we were doing in Belgium? We'll file war crimes against Ariel Sharon, that war criminal. That we tried. As many of you know, a case was charged against Ariel Sharon in 2002 in Belgium, in Brussels, charging them, indicting Ariel Sharon for his role in the 1982 massacre of 3,000 Palestinian civilians in Sabra and Shatila because of alleged terrorists in the camp. The same rhetoric they've used to go into Jenin this year. By the way, in Jenin, 15,000 Palestinians live on 1 square kilometer. Israel went into that civilian population looking for 23 alleged terrorists without proof. They attacked and massacred a civilian population no matter which way they cut it. But in Sabra and Shatila, they filed the case in 2002. Belgium accepted the case. They were going to try Ariel Sharon. One exception, they had to wait till he was out of office because of the Sovereign Immunities Act. Due to incredible amounts of international political pressure, Belgium passed a new law this August 2003, that said you can't bring any case to Belgium. There has to be a direct link. Either one of the victims or the aggressors has to be Belgian. And they dropped the case, leaving the victims of Sabra and Shatila and the rest of the Palestinian refugee population and diaspora without legal remedy. And in response, Laurent Reichman, who is the Israeli embassy spokesman, said, quote, "Now both Belgium and Israel are going to work hard to have the same friendly relations that we had before." Basically, now we can return to the comfortable status quo, where one of the strongest military powers, backed by the world's strongest superpower, is against a stateless refugee population. That's what they told us. So when people get, when people get mad at me and tell me how dare you wage a divestment campaign against Israel, isn't that inhumane that you could potentially starve Israelis? Number one, Palestinian Israelis live there too. There's nothing inhumane about my calculations. Number two, if it weren't for Israel and the United States violating and disgracing every type of international mechanism that we have available to us to solve this otherwise through legal remedies, through the Geneva Conventions, through the International Criminal Court, through universal jurisdiction, we would never have to wage a divestment campaign. So for those that tell us, how dare you, I respond, how dare you for bringing this upon yourself. You've given us no other choice. And so for this reason, I'll only discuss this issue then with people like Noam Chomsky who say, you know what? It's not Israel's fault. Why don't you wage a divestment campaign against the U.S.? But like our brother here said, they're not separated. The links are too intrinsic. The military-industrial complex that funds this U.S. economy is heavily dependent on Israel. When I divest from Israel, I divest from this military-industrial complex. I divest from the prison-industrial complex. Stop building more prisons here. Why are our African-American brothers and sisters and our Chicano brothers and sisters and our Native brothers and sisters in prison instead of in high schools and in universities? It's because you're wasting our money massacring other peoples around the world. So as much respect as I owe Noam Chomsky for his intelligence, wisdom, and contribution, I have to disagree. We have no choice to divest from Israel. And so if that's what we're faced with, we better do a damn good job. Thank you.
Both of these struggles. I wonder if you could address that for us.